Good morning, Orphans of the Storm. Thank you for coming. All right. Our first case of the day is 072449, Turner versus the Saloon. And Ms. Babbitt, good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Carol Babbitt. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Paul D. Turner. And as I sat voraciously reviewing a record that is very voluminous, I thought this morning today I would start by trying to direct Your Honor's attention to where I believe the most egregious errors in the lower court's decision are, and that is in particular regarding the retaliation claim, first and foremost. The retaliation claim is there's what I believe to be a montage of conflicting evidence that supports a retaliation claim. In the first instance, Mr. Turner has testified in numerous places in his deposition that not only was he retaliated against by the woman that he complained was harassing him, his immediate supervisor, Denise Lake, but that he was retaliated against to the point that he received adverse employment impact before he was terminated. You see, I don't even have to reach the issue of how or why he was terminated. As long as I can show that Mr. Turner suffered adverse employment impact because of the retaliation, and he's testified in numerous places in the record that he did not receive the same stations that he used to receive, and therefore his tips were less. He was making less money because of her direct impact on his employment.
Let me ask you this. Does Mr. Turner dispute that seven supervisory employees other than Dixie Lake wrote him up for a variety of infractions?
We believe that there are other... What we dispute is the nature of those write-ups. So, yes, we do... It's not necessarily that I dispute who gave him those write-ups. I dispute the motivation behind those write-ups. Seven of the write-ups were from Denise Lake. There are a few write-ups, three or four, right before he was terminated, but those were after he complained to the EEOC that he was being discriminated against. And they tried to back him into a corner with respect to how they wanted him to change his clothes.
Now, where in the record will we find evidence that counter the employer's claims?
Regarding the write-ups, Mr. Turner explains in his deposition, which is in the record, I believe, 57-3 of the record, is his testimony. And he does state in there specifically, gives a logical reason behind each and every one of the write-ups that he was given from the beginning of the time that he was there until the time that he left. And if you look at the listing of the dates of those write-ups, I believe that 99% of them were after he ended his relationship with his supervisor, Lake, which we have in the record as of November of 2002. And if you look at the dates of, I would say, 94% to 98% of those write-ups, they were after that date.
What
now,
was the date?
There's a list of all
how long
of...
afterward? Where's the list?
The list is in counsel's, the red brief, the appellee's brief.
Pages 10 to 12.
That's right.
Okay. What's the time period?
So the time period where... Yes. He was... He complained. He ended the relationship with Ms. Lake in November of 2002.
And when did he get terminated?
December of 2004.
So it's 2 years.
That's correct. And if you look, Page 10 indicates that there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 write-ups that were before he ended the relationship with her. But starting on page 11 to the end, which goes actually to page 13, all of those occurred after he ended his relationship with Ms. Lake. The retaliation permeated the atmosphere at the saloon, and he took the brunt of that. But it's not only these write-ups. You see, and here's where I believe there's a huge, egregious error in how the lower court reviewed this. We believe, and we've stated, that those write-ups are retaliatory, including the ones that were not written by Lake, especially after he complained in October of 2004 to the EEOC. And yet the defendant's argument that those write-ups show he wasn't adequately performing were given credence by the lower court. But there's case law that I've cited at the Thinensang case and also Vakaria versus Swedish Covenant that clearly do not allow a court to look at what the plaintiff is characterizing as discriminatory as a reason to terminate them. And that's really what's going on here. The defendant used all of the packed write-ups in plaintiff's file on the day they terminated him. Had he not had that packed file with those write-ups, he wouldn't have been terminated. But he was.
Well, does he admit the underlying conduct?
He does not.
In each of those violations?
In his deposition, he logically explains each and every one of those write-ups. He does. And in certain instances, I believe he indicated, yes, perhaps I did go outside in the back and smoke a cigarette, but there were at least two other people in the back smoking a cigarette with me, and they were not written up for it. They remained an employee. So justice was blind here in the sense that we were having a supervisor look to his conduct and hyper-scrutinize it in a discriminatory way, whereas other people were smoking, other people were doing personal things in the back of the room, but they weren't written up for that. And then we even have the affidavit and the deposition testimony of one of his coworkers, Ed Kniff, who admits, I did things in the back of the room, personal things. I never got written up for them. I mean, he even corroborates my client's testimony that they were coming down on him as a retaliatory measure.
Now, the employer offered to let Mr. Turner come to work in his uniform pants or to change at a nearby hotel, which I take it is leads directly into the restaurant. Why are those not reasonable alternatives to the curtain idea?
I am not necessarily saying that in the end, in the very end, when they said he could go to an alternative site, may not have necessarily been unreasonable. But the client has testified that that would have, A, caused him to incur more time. That meant he would have to get to work earlier. It also might cause danger. And there's a coworker of his, Hernandez, that also affide in his in his affidavit that if you come to work, if you come and go in a waiter's uniform, they know you have cash on you, they know you have tips. That is not a preferred way for a waiter or a server to come and go to work.
Oh, but wait a second. A pair of black pants? Any man wearing a pair of black pants?
I believe they're nylon black pants that clearly look as if it's a uniform. And I think this is a great example of how you and I should not be sitting here deciphering whether or not it's reasonable to say that
you
it was more dangerous.
Not you, but not us.
Okay. Well, I believe
that's what we get paid for.
I believe because there's testimony in the record opposing that it would have been reasonable, that we then have to take a step back and say that's for a panel of jurors to decide, not necessarily what we believe is reasonable. I also think if you look at the timing of when they admit they finally gave him some sort of solace, aside from the fecal-contaminated bathroom to change in, it was literally, I would say, a week before he left. I mean, I can't guarantee that as I stand here, but it was so close to the time that they had packed his record and had him almost ushered out the door that I think he was set up to fail no matter what he had done. And by the time they got there, you see, there were so many other instances where he had asked for reasonable accommodations. It wasn't just a curtain. He had asked to go into a chemical room, which was an aside, and it wasn't in a public area. And they had not even answered whether he could do that. I mean, they had really dragged their feet and set him up to fail. And I do see that I'm in my rebuttal period, but I'm happy to answer any important questions that you, the panel, may have. None others?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal time. Thank you. Hey, Mr. Tafada. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is James Tafada, counsel. May it please the court, I represent the saloon. I'll first address something counsel said at the end, that Mr. Turner was not given these alternative locations to change his clothes until a week before his termination. The record is clear on this point. It happened within a week of when a female employee found him nude in the changing area. And immediately from that point, they said, you've got to change the washroom. You can't be nude in our restaurant. 2 days later, Mr. Braver, the general manager, finds him nude in the storage area, the chemical room storage area. This is an open room. The record shows it has no door. It's next to the stairs. Any employee walking down would have seen a nude man in the workplace. When they found him nude, they'd already given him the alternatives. Mr. Turner was written up and suspended at that point. This is in early October. He was suspended
for
a week.
What year? Early October.
2004.
The last year he's there.
That was the last year. He was terminated on December 15th. So he was not written up for being, you know, for changing his clothes or for not wearing underwear. The fact is he was written up for insubordination, and the record shows that in his disciplinary report. Fast forward a few weeks from that point on to December 15th. Contrary to what counsel just said, the record shows he earned the same money he always earned in the past. There was no retaliation. He had the same hours he always had as in the past. He was a top earner in the restaurant. Mr. Turner was one of these high-profile NFL players, full of talent, like a Terrell Owens. I don't know if you know who he is. Full of talent, but just a real difficult player to coach. Mr. Turner had quite a bit of talent, but he was very difficult as an employee.
I want to take a closer look at the statute of limitation issue. The employer fired him, at least based in part, on a disciplinary record that included write-ups from Miss Lake. I understand why you think some of the Dixie Lake incidents are beyond the limitations period if he is strictly bringing a hostile work environment claim. But his claim also is for wrongful termination. Was he supposed to sue before he got fired? Why can't he cite those older write-ups if the employer used them in the termination decision?
He does cite them in his retaliation case, but on his cause of sexual harassment, the judge found they were not actionable prior to May.
I understand that. What I'm saying is you've got, you know, a number of counts here. One is wrongful termination. Why can't he use those Dixie Lake write-ups and get past the statute of limitation issue?
On the sexual harassment claim?
No, on the wrongful termination claim.
Which is the retaliation claim. I don't believe Judge Shader said that the prior write-ups were excluded from his consideration of retaliation.
No, but you do. In your brief.
I forgot I did that. But I, in the context of sexual harassment, yes. On the case itself. Maybe I'm missing this, but.
Well, even in a hostile work environment claim, the acts that occurred outside the limitations period are admissible. They're as part of the entire hostile work environment. So there just isn't a statute of limitations issue here unless you're attempting to sue on individual discrete acts against him committed outside the limitations period. But if the claim is, and this is how I understand the claim, is one for hostile work environment, then there isn't a limitations issue.
What the judge, what lower court found
it
was...
It doesn't matter what the lower court found. This is a summary judgment. It's de novo review. So why is my argument wrong?
Because the only incident that occurred, that came up after May 21st, 2004, was in August, which...
That doesn't matter. As long as one aspect of the hostile work environment, the sexual harassment claim, is within the limitations period, the entire context comes in, even acts outside the hostile work environment or outside the limitations period, to the extent that it's a hostile work environment claim.
To the extent it is a hostile work environment.
And that's how I understand this claim.
And the hostile work environment ended in March 2004.
As long as some part of the harassment occurred afterwards, and I understand the plaintiff to be claiming that his termination was part of the harassment because it flowed from it.
There's a seven-month hiatus. Plaintiff has not shown any connection between his termination and the hostile work environment. They alleged, without any basis, that his file was packed with write-ups. But the fact is, contrary to what they say in their briefs, from March to December when Mr. Turner was terminated, only two write-ups were from Ms. Lake, not seven.
Well, it wouldn't matter if there was one.
But they're legitimate write-ups, and the record also shows Mr. Turner admits the underlying infractions. He concedes them, and he doesn't say she's wrong. Second point is, Ms. Lake had nothing to do with this termination on that day. The record's clear. It was an independent decision based on the entire history of Mr. Turner's disciplinary record by Mr. Braver. Ms. Lake wasn't in the restaurant. Ms. Braver is her supervisor. You look at his disciplinary history, Ms. Lake is just but a part of his record. Mr. Braver had disciplined Mr. Turner an enormous amount of times. So did the other managers.
Well, that goes to the sufficiency here of the evidence to survive summary judgment. It doesn't affect the statute of limitations inquiry. As long as one of her harassing write-ups was within the limitations period, then there is no statute of limitations issue.
But if the write-up cannot be shown to have any connection...
That's a sufficiency issue. That's not a statute of limitations issue. As long as one of the acts that he contends was harassing occurred within the limitations period, and this is a hostile work environment claim, then there is no statute of limitations problem, and we should focus the discussion on whether the evidence is sufficient to carry his burden to survive summary judgment. That's the holding of the Morgan case.
Pardon me?
That's the holding of the Supreme Court's decision in Morgan.
I understand.
With regard to the sexual harassment, I'm not exactly clear. Was this a sexual relationship with the other employee consensual at some early stage?
Yes, they had a consensual relationship for about almost a year.
Okay, and this, it's the, whoever ended it, whatever, this is when the sexual harassment at least supposedly started? After
yes.
This. So there was a period of time where this relationship was consensual. And that
yes, there was.
Okay.
And during that time, he received the same number of disciplinary write-ups. I mean, if you look at his record, it flows all the way through.
You know, he contended that he had permission from a pseudo-manager to leave the restaurant to run that errand. And you didn't really respond to this argument that this woman had a managerial or supervisory authority over Mr. Turner and could allow him to leave. So could you respond to that argument
sure.
now?
The record is clear. The only person who really believes that, that Kelly Schwartz was a supervisor is the plaintiff, and they do have one employee who came forward and said, I thought she was a pseudo-supervisor. That's it. What's really, the fact is, she was a receptionist, and the record shows that she had no managerial duty. She couldn't hire, fire. She couldn't, she really was, she was a waitress in training. But what's really relevant is what Mr. Braver believed. Mr. Braver was the general manager. She was not a supervisor. She was not someone Mr. Turner could ask if he could leave the restaurant on that day. There were three managers in the restaurant. He ignored all of them and relied on the receptionist, three historic managers. That's the chef, Mr. Dresnick, Mr. Braver. So it's really not material what Mr. Turner believed. What's material is what the restaurant believed on that day when they terminated him. One of the claims was for overtime pay, which morphed into a class action. Your Honor, nothing, Your Honors, here the plaintiff is arguing that his testimony alone is enough to defeat summary judgment, and you should reverse Judge Shader on this point. I want to point out that...
Would you repeat what you just said?
The argument by Mr. Turner on the wage claims is that his testimony alone is sufficient to withstand summary judgment. His testimony, saying, and his testimony was, Miss Lake, I work with her on Sunday, every Sunday I worked, and she had me shave my hours. Their argument to this court is that is enough. That's enough to overturn or to withstand summary judgment.
What did the court do that you want reversed?
I don't want anything reversed.
What did you just
yeah,
say?
See, that's why I asked you to repeat what you just said, because it's okay. You misspoke.
That. We want to keep that.
Yeah, I would
okay.
So.
Yeah, we want to keep that.
What you're
all right,
I just wanted to make
there
sure.
There were four days, four Sundays that he worked. Two of them unequivocally, not 40 hours, and the other two, proof of payment for overtime.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's it.
That's it. And that'll be it for me, unless you have any further questions then. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Babbitt has 4.5 minutes.
Great. The first thing that I would like to pick up on is to disagree with our overtime claim. We are not contending that it is just Mr. Turner's testimony that he was asked to work overtime hours and he wasn't paid for that. There's corroborating testimony in this record from a coworker who was no longer at that restaurant and has no bias, who said not only Ms. Lake, but two other managers instructed him on many occasions not to plug in and out so that he showed overtime on his wages and hours. And that is in the record in three places.
Does the record, forgive me, but does the record show us or tell us why the coworker is no longer at the saloon?
Yes, the declaration says he was terminated, and he believes they were questionable circumstances. Yes, it does. He does honestly say he was terminated, but he believes, along with my client, believes it, and that justice was askew at that restaurant, and that there was a woman who was acting not as a waitress who wanted to be promoted to a waitress position, and it was convenient a week later after he was terminated. He believes that shows that it was who also was a prior friend of one of the managers making decisions about hiring and firing, and he feels that she got his position because she wanted to get a raise and they just simply needed the space.
Is friend a synonym for something
else? An ex-girlfriend, perhaps. I think he indicated that, yes, it seems to be that carries a lot of weight at that restaurant. But so I don't think what we're saying is
welcome
that...
Welcome to the world.
I don't think what we're saying is that, as long as it doesn't violate the law, and we're saying they crossed the line here and very egregiously did that. So I think what we're saying in the overtime claim is not just my client's testimony. It's corroborating testimony and documents. If you look at the manager's reports, now my client testified that he was told his manager edited his time cards not to show overtime. And there's corroborating evidence, hard evidence, not anybody's statement, but manager's records that say, I edited the time cards, I looked at the time cards, I changed the time cards. Well, are they going to admit that they shaved overtime? No, they're not going to admit that. But if there is this conflicting evidence in the record, and there's volumes of it, even in the overtime claim even, we need to get we need jurors to make that decision. We don't want the district court to make a credibility decision on whether my client's testimony was credible or not.
Are you saying then that he worked more than four Sundays?
Absolutely, and my client
only show four Sundays.
No, it doesn't even show that because managers don't log in and out as to the days that they worked. We don't know whether she worked on a Sunday. She's testified to that, but we don't know that for certain. My client affied in an affidavit and testified in his deposition that he worked with her way more than four Sundays. And we have to give all reasonable inferences to him. The record is not clear that she only worked on four Sundays because she doesn't check in and out like he does as far as how many days he works. It's just her testimony conflicting with my client's testimony, which creates a material question of fact.
So the pay records, the actual records that you looked at,
yes,
I assume, that are in our record,
yes,
only show four Sundays. Is that right? Did he work?
No, I believe they show seven, at least seven.
And do any of the other three show more than 40 hours that he didn't get paid overtime?
They do not show the overtime because he was told to shave that manually. So he didn't punch in and out. You see, those records show what he punched in and out. So you and I aren't going to see how much time he was there that he wasn't accounting for. And Mr. Hernandez said the same thing in Mr. Hernandez's declaration. He clearly indicates there were days he
this
was 20 hours.
This is the corroborating witness?
I'm sorry, say
this
that
is,
again.
This is your
one of the corroborating witnesses, yes.
Is it true that that witness didn't show up for a deposition?
It is true that he did not appear for his deposition, but I don't think that affects his declaration. I think if I don't present him at trial, obviously, I don't have his testimony, but for purposes of Rule 56, his...
Do we know why he didn't show up at his deposition?
I do not know why he did not show up to his deposition. I don't. Yes.
Did you attempt to secure his presence?
I did. I did. I believe that he's under a tremendous amount of employment pressure and familial pressure with his family. He has many children. That was what I learned. But I don't think that affects the credibility of what he signed in furtherance of a Rule 56 motion. I also think, before I leave, if I could state, that what is important, what might be important for your honors to do is to look at the manager's records on how many things we have mentioned three other waiters that had at least as many egregious wrongs, and they were never terminated. And my client was terminated 8 weeks after he filed a charge of discrimination.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harris.
Well, thank you to both counsel, Ms. Babbitt and Mr. DeFatta, and the case will be taken under advisement.